Welcome to the Inner Side Radio Program. My name is Scooter, and I'm back with a follow-up talk with Daryl Ray, author of The God Virus. As promised, we're back with Daryl Ray again this week to talk about sexual control exerted on believers who are infected by various forms of the God Virus. So, Daryl, you were just in the Free Thought Convention in Dallas. You want to share anything from your trip?
Oh, awesome, awesome convention. Had almost 300 people there and some great speakers. Just a fun group to be with. Got to meet several other authors, and it was just a lot of fun.
Did anybody really jump out at you?
Oh, it was fun to meet John Loftus. He's written a couple books on how he became an atheist and stuff like that. I've read his stuff and enjoyed it. Marlene Winnell, who is kind of preceded me in the whole recovering from religion movement. She's been doing it for 20 years, and her work is really good. I like her book, Leaving the Fold. Would really, if your listeners are interested in dealing with the psychological issues that come from leaving any religion, and it doesn't matter what religion, they all have the same psychological impact. So her book's really good, Leaving the Fold. But I got to talk to her and listen to her speak and talk about religious trauma syndrome. Instead of PTSD, post-traumatic syndrome, it's religious trauma syndrome. And she is openly saying, look, religion causes trauma. We need to recognize it, and we need to deal with it. Dirt did learn something, though, Scooter, a new term. I thought, this is cool, outsourcing to God. She says, when you pray, you're outsourcing to God.
I get it.
You're not taking responsibility for yourself. You're dependent on an invisible friend to take control of your life. Gave my own talk and sold out of books, totally sold out of books.
So we're back to talk about sexual control exerted by religions on its believers. And just so the viewers know, this is not a how to get more sex talk, although it may be helpful into how not to get less sex.
That's right. That's right. Part of my research now for, I think, a future article or maybe even book is looking at the impact of religion on sex. And my results are really, really preliminary. But what I'm seeing is people don't realize just how much their religion has impacted their ability to perform during sex or to enjoy sex when they're infected with religion. And when they get away from religion, it really changes their sexuality and their ability to perform and their enjoyment of sex, and especially getting rid of the guilt of this time. Every religion tries to make you feel guilty about sex. And if it can make you feel guilty about sex, then you're going to have sex anyway. I mean, everybody's going to be sexual in some way. And as a result, you're going to feel the guilt. You're going to come back to that particular God virus. Just talking to three former Muslim women. So I just, you know, I was asking them kind of in my research, how did this affect you? And two of them were just really articulate about, man, when I got away from the strict craziness of Islam's view of women and sex, I was able to finally, in the first time in my life, enjoy myself, if nothing else, just to masturbate. And many of the men, I didn't meet any men that were ex-Muslim, but I met a lot of ex-fundamentalist men. And same thing, when I got away from religion, I could start enjoying myself, let alone somebody else. Of course, fundamentalists and religious friends, well, when you leave religion, you're going to go out and have orgies and all that sort of stuff. I didn't meet anybody that did orgies regularly, but...
Darn.
Maybe my sample was just skewed. I don't know.
Better luck next time. So there you go, folks. The place to hang out is anywhere Daryl speak and hang out right outside. And, you know, with your little phone book.
I did a lot of... I put a survey out, a paper survey with 18 questions and a place to write, a whole page to write on. I just finished looking over that data and found that... There was a number of people said that once they got out of religion, they could explore their sexuality more completely and really understand who they were and what they were. And several said they discovered they were bisexual and didn't know that before. Found a number of people saying, I for the first time in my life, can masturbate without guilt. And, you know, every primate on the face of the earth masturbates. And why religion doesn't want us to masturbate is a key to understanding how religion impacts our sexuality.
That's why God gave us hands.
Well,
it's the opposing thumb, too, you know what I mean? Go ahead. I'm sorry I interrupted with my cheap joke.
So long before you are going to be sexually involved with anybody else, you're going to be sexually involved with yourself. And religion starts very early on. Almost every major religion tells you that masturbation is wrong. I mean, we even have the term self-abuse. Now, that's pretty negative. Well, we know that every primate's going to masturbate, and humans being primates, we're going to masturbate as much as anybody. In fact, we are the most sexual creatures on the earth, maybe equal to the bonobo apes, but there's nobody else more sexual than humans. So if you can inculcate guilt into somebody about something they're going to do anyway, then they have to come back to your particular God virus to get forgiveness. And it's just like the perfect con game. Get people guilty about stuff they're going to do anyway. And then, you know, Catholics don't go confess to Baptist ministers. Baptists don't confess to imams. They have to come back to their own particular God virus to get that. So you've got human beings having all this sex, and bonobo apes having all this sex, and chimpanzees having all this sex, and they're not procreating. So you got to ask the question, why are we such sexual creatures? What did evolution intend? What pushed this in that direction in evolution? And the main answer is we need social connection, and sex is the best way to do it, or is a good way to do it, not the best way, but one of the best. So evolutionarily, we are programmed to be sexual. And what religion does is come along and says, aha, we can take a ride on this. Just like venereal disease does, or just like gonorrhea does, it says, you know, humans are going to have sex, so the gonorrhea bacillus says, okay, we're going to hitch a ride on this, because they can't stop us. They're going to have sex, we can hitch a ride. Well, religion does the same thing. They're going to have sex, let's make them really feel guilty about it, and then we can hitch a ride. And the ride is, I'm going to make you feel guilty, you're going to have sex, you're going to come back to me.
You want to talk about the guilt cycle for a second?
Yeah, let's do. I think that's key to what we're talking about. Well, the guilt cycle works like this. You learn when you're young, certain things are wrong. And I don't have any problems with guilt. I think there's healthy guilt, and I think there's neurotic guilt. And healthy guilt, you learn, don't put your hand in the cookie jar before supper. It's going to spoil your supper. Your mom catches you, she slaps your hand, says, don't do that. So the next day, you learned your lesson. Don't get in the cookie jar, at least not while mom's watching. So the next day, you put your hand in the cookie jar, and when she's not watching, it tastes really good. But then after you've eaten it, you feel this twinge. And in psychology, we call this cognitive dissonance. The twinge is guilt. And it's the difference between here's the rule montage and here's the behavior you're engaging in. So that's healthy guilt. It really, you know, really shouldn't be eating cookies before your meal because you're not going to eat as much protein. You're not going to get as good nutrition. So that's a good thing. Religion comes along and says, aha, this seems to work pretty well to help control behavior. And religion says, well, let's make you feel guilty about sex. And then we can control your behavior. Just like mom controlled your behavior with guilt about the cookies, religion says, let's control your behavior through sex. Now, religion has used guilt around food as well. Almost all religions have some kind of a food taboos or food regulations. So you can use food to control behavior, but it just doesn't work as efficiently and effectively as sex does.
And it's something that everybody does, so it works in the same way.
Right. For example, if you look at the pre-contact Hawaiian culture, before the Western culture came along, sex was a very wide open thing. Marriage was very loosely structured. A man or a woman could be married to each other and still have multiple sex partners outside the marriage. Nobody seemed to care. It wasn't that big a deal. But the food issues were supreme. And there were certain foods that only royalty could eat, certain foods that only adult males could eat, certain foods children could not eat. All this regulations around food. And it was very strong. I mean, they would kill people. You could be executed for eating the food that only kings could eat. And there was a lot of cultures around the world before major religions came, that were open, very open sexually, but very closed with respect to food. Well, the more modern religions, Islam, and I'm gonna include Buddhism and Hinduism as modern because they are post-agriculture. When agriculture came in, sexuality changed. Hunter-gatherer tribes had a different view of sexuality oftentimes than what we see in Hinduism and Islam and Christianity. These came along and said, you know, food isn't nearly as powerful a controller as sex is. I mean, they just kind of discovered this. Don't hear me saying that religion is intentional about this stuff. It's an evolutionary process. And if you understand how evolution works, evolution simply goes the direction where is the most success.
Right. In other words, what would you call it? A mutation develops, and people have this weird idea, and then that weird idea makes the thing propagate even more, so the weird idea survives. Even though generations down the road, nobody knows where it came from or why, they're just practicing it because that's what makes the religion keep going.
Oh, absolutely. That's
the infection.
Weird ideas, you have no idea where they came from.
Right.
And many of them predated the religion you're in. I mean, Christians think they invented all this.
It's like Americans thinking that they invented Christianity.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot to this guilt cycle thing that I wanted people to be aware of when I wrote The God Virus, to really understand how it works. There's a lot of evidence that hunter-gatherer societies had a very different approach to sexuality. There's a great article in the National Geographic last December on the Hazda, and they are a hunter-gatherer society that had very little contact with the West. They're so different that they don't even have gods. They didn't even bury their dead until fairly recently. They just let the hyenas eat their corpses, and there wasn't a lot of mourning around death, and there wasn't jealousy in terms of sexuality. People pretty much mate with whoever they like. The woman pretty much controls the relationship. Guy moves in with a woman. 3 or 4 years later, she gets tired of him. She kicks him out. Somebody else comes in. But there's really no concept of marriage. And what's pretty evident is hunter-gatherer societies of 12,000 years or earlier, long before agriculture started, seem to have more fluid sexuality. I mean, how do you keep control of your mate if you're picking up and moving camp every week or every month? It's harder to keep control. But when agriculture came in, and that's the theory, agriculture came in, sexuality, not only did we settle down, but we forced the sexuality to settle down. And you know, it's hard to own a woman if she can get up and walk away. But in agricultural societies, ownership of the woman, ownership of the children, became key to the whole agricultural idea.
Ownership of labor, ownership of the goods produced, ownership of civilization seems to be based on ownership.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So in order to maintain that control, men could own their wives, men owned the children, men owned the crops, the produce, the land, you know, all that stuff. It means women are controlled, not men. So you get the fact that most of those societies were polygamous. Monogamy is a pretty new idea, actually. In agricultural societies or settled societies, it wasn't that important to most hunter-gatherer societies. I mean, yes, there were some, but we have to really look at what the word monogamy is, and that's another part of the whole religious control thing.
Native Americans are a pretty interesting exception in some regards. I have some friends that are traditional Native Americans who were basically isolated until maybe 40 years ago, and but they still live on the reservation. They still pretty much marry within the Choctaws and the Cushitas. They still marry each other. And they're still matriarchal societies. In other words, all of the goods, property, and everything comes down through the woman.
Yes.
And right. So if you're marrying into property, that's the men that marry into the property and so forth. Yeah. I'm not sure how monogamy still fits in the modern version of Native American society.
Well, I think we think the monogamy has been around a long time. It's actually a very new invention, and it was mainly invented to make sure the property and that sort of stuff stayed within the family. But if you go back, the majority of the people, the vast majority of the people on the face of the earth were living in hunter-gatherer societies until fairly recently. I mean, probably as late as 2,000 years ago, most of the people on the face of the earth were not farmers. They were hunter-gatherers. And we know that the sexual mores and taboos of hunter-gatherers are oftentimes dramatically different than us.
Right.
And the whole idea of monogamy is silly to them. And it's actually silly to even the fundamentalists. I mean, if you look at it, the highest divorce rate among all groups in the nation is Southern Baptists. So if you just look at their Bible, it's very clear. There is absolutely no doubt. Jesus said, you marry one person and you stay married to him for your entire life, period. There is no room for divorce with the exception of adultery. And then you shouldn't remarry. So if you go by the religionist's own definition of monogamy, almost 50% of them, if they're Baptists, 50% of them are not monogamous. If you've had two or more wives or two or more husbands, you're a polygamist. Call it what it is. Because that's the definition in the Bible. You've had multiple spouses.
So let's get back to divorce in these evangelical populations being so high. Do you think that's because of the ingrained sexual oppression that predates that? That why that people have such a hard time staying married and getting along?
Probably. Probably. I mean, you're trying to put a round peg in a square hole. Or a square peg in a round hole. I guess the Baptists are pretty square, so it's a round hole. There's absolutely a major pun intended there.
Right, right. That, like the Abbott Costello, who's on top?
Yeah. So these folks are, they're being taught something that goes so much against the biological nature of humans. I have a saying in my talks about, I call it, religion is a sexually transmitted disease. It's one of my talks. I talk about how religion is trying to change our biological nature. If you just look at the biology of humans, it's going to be incredibly difficult to get humans to be monogamous. We're just not built that way. We're built for lots and lots of sex. And try to force people to not do that is like trying to force them not to eat sexual.
So let's talk about how these religions discourage intermarriage, and then also how this whole thing around birth control and abstinence and how that works to their advantage.
Right, right, yeah. Well, of course, the Catholics have been against birth control, period. That's been a big thing of theirs.
So why do you think that is?
Well, because the more kids you have, the more you can infect.
Bingo.
It's the same thing with the Mormons. Mormons are, you know, have a lot of kids, infect them all with the Mormon virus, and will grow. We talk about horizontal and vertical infection. And a vertical infection is where you get it from your parents. Any disease, including religion. So it's a good strategy to have lots and lots of kids. The trouble is, with education and with technology, people, being biological, want to have more sex. So you give them birth control, the religion has to adjust to that. And religions are always saying, well, God's word never changes. We have lots of evidence it's changing constantly. The religion wouldn't survive if it didn't change at least a little bit to accommodate some of these sexual needs that people normally have. So the Protestants got with the program and said, wow, people are going to do birth control anyway. Let's not make it too sinful, or let's not say too much against it. You know, early on, even the Protestants were against birth control. You go back to the late 1800s and early 1900s when Margaret Sanger was running around trying to teach birth control. Protestant ministers were trying to get her put in jail.
That's coming back with the evangelicals, obviously.
Yeah.
Right, so that's resurging in Protestantism. But what's interesting is that the more they discourage birth control and encourage abstinence, the more children these people have. Therefore, they still get the benefit of their own population not being controlled and just spreading larger. And, of course, they'll be raised within the flock, and the virus propagates.
Yeah, absolutely. The highest teenage birth rate among all religious groups is Southern Baptist.
That may seem like a mistake, evolutionarily speaking, for the virus. It's not a mistake at all. It works quite well.
You're absolutely right. That's exactly the way the virus works. Well, that young teenage girl that has a baby out of wedlock is going to raise that baby Baptist because she feels so guilty about what she did. She was taught the guilt. She'll come back to the Baptist church. Now, she may not do it immediately, but eventually they come back in droves because they're feeling guilty about having that baby too early or whatever. Well, abstinence-only thing, the highest STDs and the highest teenage birth rates are in the religious groups that preach abstinence the most, because they're not teaching them preventative majors like condoms and how to have safe sex.
And coincidentally, their numbers grow.
They do have higher birth rates. But the highest birth rate is not among those groups because they are getting a message to some degree. I mean, there is birth control among those groups. It's the higher birth rates are among other groups. The Mormons still have a very high birth rate. Latino Catholics still have a higher birth rate. And those God viruses are working very well because they somehow, they all sometimes are isolated. You go to Utah, the Mormons are very isolated from the rest of U.S. culture. So you can continue to do that. Look at the fundamentalist Mormons, man.
Yeah.
You get three or four or five wives and you have 20 or 40 kids. That God virus is working extremely well there.
Yeah, we had a big hive of them over here in Texas.
Yeah, right.
Right,
yeah.
And that made a big news. You know what surprised me? If you go back and you look at the news stories about that, I forget where in Texas that was. It was a big deal about 3 years ago. If you look at when they were hauling everybody off, all the children off, all the buses were from the First Baptist Church.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, look at the pictures. When I saw that, I went, wow.
Yeah.
I felt real uneasy about that. It looked like a religious war going on there rather than somebody giving a crap about
the
kids.
There were elements of that for sure. Yeah. One thing that I talk about in the book, and that is the alpha male phenomena. And, of course, that's part of it, the way the fundamentalist Mormons are.
That's more chimp than bonobo.
Yeah, that part of it's more chimp than bonobo, you're right. And if you look at these scandals, just look on, there's a website called StopBaptistPredators.org.
Right.
If you just look at that website, you will see hundreds of Baptist ministers who have engaged in inappropriate sexual behavior. And you got to ask, if these guys are the best trained and most godly, what's going on here? And my analysis is a simple anthropological analysis. The alpha male is very attractive. Is very attractive to females. Females are going to flock to the alpha male. The alpha male will have his pick of a wide variety of possible sexual partners. And that's what's going on with the leaders of these mega churches. I mean, they got thousands of women. And if you, as more evidence for that, if you look at who is attending church, if you go to any Protestant or Catholic church, you're going to see 60% or more of the attendees are female. Women are much more attracted to the alpha male preacher, to that. And of course, there's other things going on, the security and the child rearing and the social stuff that seems to draw the female of our species more. It's very interesting to see these alpha males. They take advantage of their opportunities, so they're just being alpha males of the human primate species.
And they have their own word for it, which is charismatic.
Exactly.
we're just doing the tip of the iceberg of this book. Some of the other things that are in the book are the rise of modern evangelicals, which are now mainstream, so that's real interesting. There's a lot of comparative religion, personal psychological ramification, and a big part of the book is recovery from religion, which we haven't really touched on, but I will let the folks buy the book and go to the website, Recovering Religionist, for that. And I wasn't sure. I wanted to touch on one more subject, and I wasn't sure if I couldn't decide over the 5% solution or the end time strategy. But the end time strategy is so much more apocalyptic that it's so much, especially with the interest in zombies with the kids these days. So you want to talk about the end time strategy for a minute and how that works to the advantage of God viruses?
Yeah, well, everybody has an existential fear of death. That's very normal. And if a religion comes along and says, okay, we can make people be afraid of death by creating this idea that Jesus is going to come back at any time, then it takes the existential fear of death and brings it to now. Most of us feel like, yeah, I'm going to live 70, 80 years. I don't have to worry too much about it. But if I can inculcate fear of death, that Jesus might come back and I would go straight to hell in the next 5 days, 5 years, 20 years, then it really forces people, it brings another control mechanism. We've talked about sex, of course, but death is a huge control mechanism. And it brings what I call neurotic fear of death. It's all organisms, all sentient organisms, are afraid of death. There's nothing wrong with that. It's self-preservation. It keeps the species going. But you can have an unnatural or abnormal or a neurotic fear of death. And that's what the whole end times thing does, is it creates a neurotic fear of death, makes people feel like, dang, I better get my house in order. I better start behaving right, or Jesus can come back and spank me and send me to hell. So both guilt around normal things like sex and guilt around normal things like death is heightened when you can create a neurosis around it, and people develop unnatural and unhealthy levels of fear. Well, if you're afraid of dying at any minute, going to hell at any minute, you're going to change your behavior, and that behavior is going to be in line with your particular God virus. Because those end time people aren't going to the priest to find out about the end time. They're going to the Baptist minister or the dispensationalist or the end timist, you know, any of those cuckoos. They have to come back to their particular God virus. And Jehovah's Witnesses have been using this far longer than anybody else.
Okay.
They're among the best.
It's always been a part of Christianity because Jesus said he was coming back pretty much next week.
Yeah, before you got, and the people I'm talking to today are die, I'll be back.
That's why I love the Church of Subgenius. They predicted the end of the world in 1998, and then they just have volumes and volumes of jokes about how, well, this isn't really 1998. This is, you know, somebody screwed up the calendar, and, you know.
Every generation is somebody predicting the end of the world.
Right, and if there's any doubt about how twisted these people are, you could go to their chat rooms and websites and blogs and so forth, and whenever something really terrible happens in the Middle East or something, they're just overjoyed. They're like, oh, look, oh, the end times are coming. You know, thousands of people die, and they just couldn't be more happy about it. And that's a really dangerous way to look at the world.
It sure is. Like, some of these folks are encouraging war between Israel and its neighbors. They'd love to see that.
Oh, yeah, that's John Hagee and his that whole gang. Right.
Hagee's a nut, yeah.
A more anti-Semitic person there probably could not be.
Right,
but he's
down
with Israel, you know. So thanks for joining us, Daryl, and we'll talk to you again sometime.
Okay.
All right.
Have me on, Scooter.
Daryl Ray is author of The God Virus, which has a website, thegodvirus.net. Which also has links to resources for those recovering from religion and spiritually related metaphysical pandemics. This and all previous Innerside Radio programs are stockpiled at the internet's hermetically sealed in air quality MP3 format. Simply Google The Innerside. My name is Scooter, and I'll see you all next week.
Do you make this request of your own free will?
Yes.